Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to the Renaissance English History Podcast. I'm your host, Heather Tesco, and I'm a storyteller who makes history accessible because I believe it's a pathway to understanding who we are, our place in the universe, and our connection to our own humanity. This is episode 70. We're doing another joint episode with Melita Thomas of Tudor Times. This one's on John Dudley. Just a quick note that the Renaissance English History Podcast is a proud member of the Agora Podcast Network, which you can learn more about and discover some new favorite podcasts at agorapodcastnetwork.com. Remember, you can get links to more information, resources, and sign up for my mailing list at englandcast.com. At the end of this episode, Melita mentioned several resources for Dudley, for example, and I've included those links on the website in the show notes for this episode. So now let me introduce you to Melita. Melita is a co-founder and editor of Tudor Times, a website devoted to Tudor and Stuart history from the period between 1485 and 1625. You can find it at tudortimes.co.uk. Melita, who has always been fascinated by history ever since she saw the 1970s series Elizabeth R with Glenda Jackson, also contributes articles to BBC History Extra and Britain Magazine. And we started off the interview by me, as usual, asking her to tell us a little bit about John Dudley's life and why she chose him as the person of the month this month.
Dudley is famous under his title of Duke of Northumberland as perhaps one of the great Tudor villains. He's held responsible for the attempt to put Lady Jane Grey on the throne, which resulted in Jane's death at the age of 17. And he was seen in his time as a tyrant and a sort of greedy, ambitious man. I think he's perhaps more complex than that. And his background, he was the son of one of Henry VII's closest advisors. And so he had to overcome the hurdle of the fact that Henry VII's advisor, Edmund Dudley, was executed for treason in the early part of Henry VIII's reign. As Dudley Sr. was blamed very much for Henry VII's rather, repressive financial regime. So it was quite handy to have somebody to throw to the dogs, which Henry VIII, ruthless from an early age, did. So young Dudley was overshadowed in his early life by the fact that his father had been executed for treason. The reason we picked him for this person of the month is because, you know, partly because of that achievement, to go from being the son of a traitor to being the most powerful man in England when he was Lord President of the Council and effectively the regent for Edward VI. He's sort of an archetype for the rise of what they called the new men. They weren't of aristocratic birth, but he achieved his position through a good deal of hard work and loyal service to the state, but also quite a bit of intrigue and ambition. He's a complex character, actually. I can't say I've particularly warmed to him, but there are some positive aspects to his character as well. And I think he comes across as a very, very intelligent, very driven man, very, very skilled in administration, quite a very strong and forceful character. I can imagine that he was probably rather a bully, actually, and that's how he got his way, because he'd have, you know, overwhelming force of character.
Mm-hmm. So, like, his background and his family, it seems that scheming and these kind of potentially treasonous activities were something that kind of ran in his family. And it seems like some families, like, just kind of are like that, like the Howards as well. Why do you think that is? What with him?
Well, to be fair, I think it's probably the case that every family in Tudor England had a few relatives who came to grief. I mean, it was a piranha pool. I think certainly Dudley Sr., his father, was, there's no evidence at all that he was in any way treasonable. He was carrying out Henry VII's orders. And yes, he probably lined his pockets. I'm pretty sure he lined his pockets, but he wasn't doing anything that the king wasn't aware of or happy about. He was accused of treason as a way of deflecting unpopularity away from the king, you know, the late king, onto another individual, to give everybody a feel good factor when Henry VIII came to the throne. So it is a bit harsh that he was, you know, considered to be a traitor. And John Dudley, the son, I think he was a risk taker. He was a military commander who. It looks from what you can see that he would take a calculated risk and he would deliver on it. So he'd weigh up, you know, a number of important military campaigns that he was involved in, and he'd weigh the odds, and he would take a chance based on good odds. But where he came undone, perhaps, was underestimating that his opponent, Mary, she actually had a very high appetite for risk as well. Mm. Well, that's not the persona that people imagine of her, but when you actually look at how she lived her life, she was a risk taker, and Northumberland probably, you know, in the manner of the time, assumed that a woman wouldn't take that kind of risk.
Mm.
Yeah, and I was thinking, I mean, I was saying before, I think he had a strong personality, but I also think he, like many people who are strong, charismatic, people follow him. He was a natural leader.
Mm-hmm. So what motivated him, do you think?
You know, when I first thought about that question, I thought, well, you know, greed and ambition, because that's the obvious answer. But I think there is a more complex element to it. Certainly financially, he was very acquisitive. And, you know, I think it's obvious that he connived at his stepfather being defrauded of money. And it's fairly clear that, when people owed him money, he was quite prepared to send the heavies in. Mm-hmm. You know, there's definitely an element that he was quite ruthless like that. But I think he was also, I think the example of his father made him nervous. As I said before, Dudley Sr., he'd served Henry VII very faithfully, but that wasn't enough. You know, he still was executed for treason. And I think Dudley, who was obviously very conscious about his father, he wrote about his poor father who had been badly treated. I think he realised that when Edward VI was dying, he was afraid that if Mary became queen, even if he hadn't done anything wrong, he would be the scapegoat for the religious policies that had been followed under Edward that Mary was bound to reverse. So I think it was possibly a preemptive strike, because he saw the example of his father before him. I mean, I don't know that, but that is. The conclusion I've come to, yes, he wanted to be top dog and he didn't want to be to lose out, but I think he was afraid that he would end up executed anyway.
Interesting. What was his personal life like? You know, I think I just think about him plotting his son, you know, this whole situation. Like, what was his personal life like other than that?
He and his wife were deeply attached to each other. Her name is Jane Gifford, or Guildford, discussion on how to pronounce that one, and she was the son of his guardian. So when his father was executed, his mother, Elizabeth Grey, she was married to actually the king's half-uncle, Arthur Plantagenet. So which brought him sort of into the orbit of the royal family, because Henry was very fond of his uncle. So we don't know anything about his relationship with his mother, because he was the ward of Sir Edward Gifford, and then he married Gifford's daughter, Jane, and they were devoted to each other. They had 13 children, rather astonishingly unpleasant idea, but there you go. And at the end, when he was imprisoned, and his wife Jane, she was, you know, she pleaded for his life. She wrote that she was more worried about him than she was about her children, because he was such a good man and she'd been so devoted to him, and, you know, she was obviously loved him very much. But the whole family life seems to have been very happy. All of the Dudley siblings were very close to each other throughout the lives, the ones who survived into older age. Mm. And he seems to have been unusually close to his children. Mm. So that's a positive positive aspect.
The obvious stuff that he's known for. Tell me about the Lady Jane Grey plot, and the whole kind of situation with that, and just the background of all.
Yes, it's interesting. There've been some different interpretations of late on who was responsible for what. But just as the background, so in 1544, Parliament passed an act of succession, which designated Henry VIII's successors as firstly his son, Edward, as was the case under the common law. And he was to be followed, if he had no children, by Henry VIII's elder daughter, Mary, and any children she might have, and then by the younger daughter, Elizabeth. And the act also gave Henry the power to nominate further successors, should it transpire that Elizabeth, you know, that none of his children had children of their own. So because there was sort of a choice of successors after Henry's own children. There were the descendants of his elder sister Margaret, but that was the King of Scotland, or his half sister Margaret Douglas, the Countess of Lennox, or there were the descendants of his younger sister Mary, the French Queen. Now Henry, for whatever reason, decided that he preferred the descendants of his younger sister, probably because he didn't want Scotland to be anywhere near the succession. But he didn't nominate his actual niece, Frances, probably because he thought her husband, Henry Grey, was an idiot. And there's no other way of putting it, really. All the descriptions of him were, there's very positive stuff about his piety and his learning and his generosity and all the rest of it. But, you know, every description of him suggests that he really was not the sharpest knife in the drawer. He was a poor military commander, and just, you know, Henry VIII was a good judge of ministers, and he never let Henry Grey anywhere near his council. So I've referred to him as Henry Grey, but at the time that the will was made, he was Marquess of Dorset. So at Henry's death, he was to be succeeded by his children and then by the children of his niece, Frances, of whom the oldest was a daughter, Jane. And the Grey family were Protestants. And Edward VI, as he obviously didn't live to grow up, and he became more and more firmly Protestant as he got older. And he was concerned. Now, whether this was his own idea or whether it was put into his mind by Northumberland has been a question, and we'll never know exactly. But he decided that he should cut his sisters out of the succession. Mm. And he decided, first of all, he was going to name only male heirs. He was, at 15 years old, he was a rank misogynist. He was scouting around looking for male heirs, but there weren't any, because Jane had no brothers. She wasn't married. None of her sisters were married. There was nothing but women to choose from. So Edward had to give in and decide it was going to be Jane herself and any heirs she subsequently had. And surprisingly, very soon after Edward came up with this scheme, Northumberland's son married Jane. Now, I know, it's astonishing, isn't it? Now, the late and very well regarded Professor Ives, his opinion is this was just a perfectly ordinary marriage between members of the nobility, and they had no ulterior motive at all, which I don't think is a view that most people would have now, or had then, in fact, because there was talk at the time that it was highly suspicious that Northumberland was clearly plotting something. So, I mean, it was clearly Edward wanted this to happen, but as I say, whether he completely came up with the idea himself or whether it was suggested to him, which is certainly not impossible because, as I said before, Northumberland had a very strong personality. But regardless of where the idea came from, it was not, it wasn't legal. Because Edward, for a number of reasons, first, he was a minor, so he couldn't actually make a will in law. Second, even though he persuaded the judges to draw it up as a thing called letters patent, which are, you know, direct orders from the king, they don't have the force of law that is greater than an act of parliament. They couldn't, he could not overturn an act of parliament by letters patent. So what needed to happen was for Edward to live until Parliament could pass a new succession act, but didn't. So Northumberland decided, you know, he was going to take the chance anyway, and persuaded, bullied, encouraged the rest of the council to agree with him. And Jane was proclaimed as queen, and nobody in the country was at all keen on the idea. So he probably assumed that Mary, having been cut out of the succession, would either just give in, or that she would, perhaps go abroad to her European relatives. But he certainly doesn't seem to have been expecting that she would raise an army, mm-hmm. which she very promptly did, had a huge amount of public support. So Northumberland, so it was decided by the Council of Queen Jane, as they termed her, that an army would have to be raised to go and try to capture Mary. And Northumberland was obliged to lead it. He had hoped to stay back in London, but the weight of all of the rest of the council and Jane herself was that he should lead it. It was no good Jane's father trying to lead it, because he'd already failed notably in any kind of military expedition, whereas Northumberland was a very fine military leader. But there was no public support for it. Mary's support was so great that Northumberland gave in without actually fighting. He was arrested, carried off to the Tower, and quite swiftly executed. And that was the end of him. I mean, he gambled and he lost. Mm. But it was a bold move.
So on the surface, just with that, he sort of seems like this villain, like you called him earlier, that he's known as. And you said that he was very close with his family. What else redeeming quality, what other redeeming qualities does he have?
Not so much a personal thing, but as I say, he was a very competent administrator. He was a good military leader. Whether that's a virtue or not, but I mean, in his time, it would certainly have been considered a virtue. But he also, one rather nice story is that when James V died after the Battle of Solway Moss, he was Viscount Lisle at that time. Lisle wrote to Henry VIII that he'd stood the army down because he did not think it was honourable to prosecute war on a corpse, a widow and a suckling babe. So he was, it was not completely dishonourable. I mean, he could have just led his army and completely overcome the Scottish forces, which had been so badly mauled at Solway Moss. So he certainly had a sense of honour. It's not clear. I mean, he and Somerset, who had preceded him as the Lord Protector, in their younger days, they'd been actually very close friends, and they'd sort of come up with a scheme to defraud Northumberland's stepfather. After he moved, he sort of got rid of Somerset from power. He didn't rush to have him executed, or now whether that was because he didn't want to look like the bad guy, or whether it was he genuinely had some, didn't want to take that route. You can't know, but so I think he was just, well, good and bad like everybody. It was definitely a dog eat dog world, and I think the example he'd seen of his family, and if I should think half of Henry VIII's court was suffering from post-traumatic stress, because all the ones who didn't win, they didn't just lose, they lost their heads. So the stakes were very high. You couldn't just sort of say, my bid for power didn't really come off, so I'll just go and live in the country. It was much more brutal than that. So as soon as you'd started to to be ambitious. You almost couldn't stop. Mm-hmm. So yeah, no, he's a complex character, and I mean, I have to say, I think he and his wife sound, say they're very, very devoted to each other, but they're completely convinced that they ought to have all the power and wealth they wanted.
Interesting. And where can we learn more about him?
Well, funnily enough, it's not that easy. David Lodes, the late David Lodes, who died last year, he wrote a biography of him back in the 1980s, which I haven't been able to get hold of, in fact. So I don't know if it's out of print, but I certainly haven't been able to get hold of. He's very much talked about in books about other people. So there's Chris Skidmore's biography of Edward VI, which is very good. Professor Ives' book that I mentioned before, which is called The Mystery of Lady Jane Grey. Nicola Tallis just a few weeks ago published one called The Crown of Blood, which is about Jane Grey. So he's a peripheral character in other people's lives. There's an introductory book by a lady called Christine Hartwig, who I'm not sure how she pronounces that, Hartway, who has a website about the Dudleys. So that's a good overview. But most of there's an awful lot of records because he was Lord Admiral. He was Lord Admiral of the fleet at the time that the Mary Rose sank. It happened that he was on the other ship, on the flagship, the Great Harry, but it happened right in front of his eyes. So there's an awful lot of correspondence about his military career in the letters and papers of Henry VIII. So you can find out, and because he was so involved in litigation, I mean, he was permanently in a court case. So there's lots about his financial transactions as well.
Mm, interesting. So I'll put links to all of that stuff up in the show notes about this so people can see more. Awesome. Well, thank you for telling us about him.
Yes. Well, thank you. Thank you for listening. With the Person of the Month features that we do at Tudor Times, because we're looking in a reasonable amount of depth at a lot of different people, it's very interesting to see how they all interplay. So when you're looking at it for something from the opposite point of view. So last February, when it was Mary the First's 500th anniversary, we looked at her. And now, of course, I'm looking at it from the other point of view to see Dudley's perspective. And it is actually interesting to look at all these things from the different people's perspectives.
Thank you again to Melita Thomas for taking the time to tell us about John Dudley. For more information on him, go to tudortimes.co.uk or see the resources available on the Englandcast site at englandcast.com. Later on this week, I'll have the episode on Henry VIII's foreign policy towards France. And then after that, we'll have an entire episode just on the Field of Cloth of Gold. So stay tuned for that. It's going to be golden. Yes, I really just said that. Honestly, since I've become a mom, like, I do the corniest stuff. I'm wearing my mom jeans, and I'm saying it's going to be golden. But it is, so you're going to want to stay tuned. That's going to be next week. This week, Henry VIII in France. All right, have a great week, everybody. I will talk to you in just a couple of days. Bye-bye.
Ich hot aboard in Bauerbrick, at solis emlis on sich, mensk full maiden of nicht fair and fraid to fonder, in all this world flesh a one aboard of blood and of bone, never yet in Ooster known, not somewhere in London, blow northern wind, send for maybe's waiting, blow northern.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.